This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Armistead Maupin once wrote that being a gay humorist in the AIDS era is like being Henny Youngman at Auschwitz. Maupin is best known for his Tales of the City, a series of six novels set in San Francisco. Critic Walter Kendrick described Maupin as portraying a microcosm in which every sexual bent, homo, hetero, bi, trans, and undecided, coexists amid comprehensive love and respect. Now Maupin has completed his first novel since the series ended. It's called Maybe the Moon, and it brings us a new cast of characters and a change of venue. It's set in Hollywood and is told from the point of view of a 31-inch-tall actress who's trying to prove she can play more than freak roles. Her claim to fame is that she was the anonymous actress underneath the rubber suit playing the elf character in the second most popular movie of all time. This novel was inspired by Maupin's late friend Tamara Dutrow, who wore the extraterrestrial costume in several scenes of E.T. I asked Maupin why he wanted to write about her and Hollywood.
Well, I felt that there was a fascinating parallel there between her life and the lives of a lot of people in Hollywood and around Hollywood who are required to remain invisible in order to support Hollywood's idea of what fantasy is. I'm speaking here of gays and lesbians quite specifically, but also African-Americans, Asians, Jews, anyone who's told that their lives, their shape, their presence is somehow or other not in keeping with the sort of white bread American fantasy machine. So my friend Tammy seemed to me the most extreme example of that. It was interesting to me during the last year when a lot of gays and lesbians were protesting Basic Instinct, and the argument was made that gays and lesbians are never seen in films unless they are objects of extreme ridicule or made to seem sinister, extremely scary. Well, little people have been saying this for years as well. When you think about it, the dwarves that you see in movies are always the objects of humor, buffoons, or they're scary little creatures that are made to seem extremely wicked. And that's what we do in this culture, essentially, with anyone who's different. We don't humanize them at all.
Now, there's a kind of funny, I've seen that's both like funny and makes you angry at the same time, in which this actor who's still in the closet because of his career is in a hotel with his lover, who's a writer and an activist, who's very out. And then the actor's agent shows up, and the writer has to kind of hide in another room and says, "God, this is like a Feydeau novel or something," you know.
Yeah. Especially because all three men are gay.
Right, right.
The agent is gay, the actor is gay, the writer is gay, but the gay actor has promised his agent that he won't have any homosexual relationships while he's making this movie, so he has to hide another gay man from another gay man. And this is simply my way of observing where the homophobia of Hollywood comes from. It's not, for the most part, generated by heterosexuals. It's generated by homosexuals in positions of power who are trying to keep the lid on, who say, this is the way you make money. You remain invisible. You shut up about it. I'm able to be out because I'm an agent. I'm a manager. I can do this. I can take my boyfriend to the restaurant. You can't do it. You're supposed to be a movie star, and movie stars are not supposed to be homosexual. So we have a system that perpetuates itself, and I don't see much movement in that direction. I mean, I think that's going to keep on happening.
I know that you feel that people who are gay should just be out. Is it a burden to you to keep somebody secret when they don't want to be out? Or when they feel that they can't be out for professional reasons?
It's more of an insult than a burden, because I feel that it reduces me to a kind of second-class citizen to even have to keep that secret for that friend. So, it bothers me, and I generally tell people when it bothers me. And some of my friendships have ended because of that. I can think of certain actors in Hollywood where I've told them I was tired of waiting and I didn't think we could really be friends, because it does reduce you to a kind of second-class citizenship.
What's the difference between a secret and privacy?
Well, I think privacy has to do with what goes on in the bedroom, with really deep innermost secrets. I don't consider the fact that a person has a lifelong partner of the same sex to be an issue of privacy any more than I would consider it an issue of privacy to know that Robert Redford has a wife somewhere. I think we have a real dual standard when it comes to our discussion of homosexuality and our discussion of heterosexuality. The reigning way of operating has been to assume that any mention of homosexuality is an invasion of privacy. And I think until that changes, we're not going to lift the taboos on homosexuality. That's what plagues me about it.
But if you have a friend who feels that it's in their best interest to stay in the closet, can they trust you with their secret?
No, because I don't respect that secret. I don't have friends like that. My friends are all out of the closet.
Even all your friends in Hollywood?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, most of them are. In fact, all of them are. The people I'm really close to are people like David Hockney, Sir Ian McKellen. These are really some of my closest friends. Don Bacardi, who lives in Hollywood and was Christopher Isherwood's lover for many years. I don't know many actors for that very reason. Michael Kearns is a friend of mine. He's out of the closet. When I discover that someone's gay and closeted, I make an effort to convince them that this is what they should do, and sometimes they run screaming into the woods and I never see them again. I feel a real responsibility to put pressure on these people because nobody else is doing it. And I think it's time we started questioning these values. If homosexuality is officially going to remain the biggest taboo in our society, then I'm going to do everything I can to break that down. And that means putting, you know, individual pressure on people.
How do you do it? How do you try to convince people to come out?
Well, what I did with Ian McKellen was simply answer his questions, because he is a man of great conscience to begin with, and he asked me and my lover Terry if we thought he should come out of the closet, and we said, yeah, we think you should. You're famous enough. you're an extremely successful man. It would mean a lot to a lot of other people. We don't think it would hurt your career. And in fact, did not. He's making movies right now as we speak. And he was knighted by the Queen after he came out of the closet. But fundamentally, we told him we felt he'd be a happier person. We felt that his life would change, that he would feel truer to himself, that his art would improve, which everyone seems to think has. And We told him we felt he had a moral responsibility to do it.
Writer Armistead Maupin is my guest. His new novel is Maybe the Moon. After a short break, we'll be joined by Armistead's lover and business partner, Terry Anderson. This is Fresh Air. Terry Anderson is joining us. And Terry, just to give all this a context, you handle all the business relations
right.
for Armistead. You're touring together on this book tour for
right.
the new book. And you've been together for
seven years. A few weeks ago, in fact.
So now let me get back to this Ian McKellen story. So, Armistead was telling us about
yeah.
how you both convinced him to come out. Tell me what you both told him about what to expect, because I'm sure he had concerns.
Well, you know, Ian, the argument is always that leading men and leading women can't come out of the closet. Ian was never a leading man. I mean, at least in the last several years of his career, he's not been. So he just felt like he was the logical person to do it, because he was in a position as the foremost actor of his generation, the foremost classical actor of his generation, to say, you know, yes, I'm gay. And it didn't even arise until we had these long discussions in San Francisco, and he went back to Great Britain and was on the radio with a homophobe arguing against a homophobic ordinance, not unlike the ones that are going on right now in Oregon and in Denver. And the homophobe was sort of saying nasty things about homosexuals, and Ian just simply said, as a gay man, everyone sort of dropped their teeth, and then when they recovered, he was out of the closet.
Terry, do you share Armistead's point of view that you would prefer not to keep people's secrets if you know they're in the closet?
We share our views on everything almost completely. Yes, we don't keep secrets. Don't ask me to keep a secret, because it's not my responsibility to do that. So when people say, don't, you know, keep my secret, I say, no, don't tell me.
Armistead, you're a little older than
15
you are,
years,
Terry.
Yeah.
So you're of like slightly different generations in terms of kind of gay politics in America. Do you know what I mean? Because so much has happened in that 15-year gap in your age. So I imagine like your coming out stories are pretty different. And
you know, it's funny.
Because
I'd
imagine
things,
like the way it was seen like socially by friends and family would be pretty different because of that time change.
One of the things we have in common is that we consider ourselves the same gay age.
We really do.
yeah. This makes sense when you think about it now.
Armistead and I came out during 1976, 1977, the same period of time.
Anita Bryant brought us out at the same time.
I was 15 years younger. I was 16 years old when it happened. Armistead was, you know, older. But
a slow learner.
I came out of the closet very early. And I think we experienced a lot of the same. We both experienced pre-age sexuality, first of all, of being able to go out to bathhouses and to have sex with, you know, frankly, with me, with large numbers of other men, who it changed my experience and my views about life. And I think it formed my views in many ways. And I think the same thing happened with Armistead. So when we met in Atlanta 7 years ago, it was one of those things where we couldn't stop talking. All of our experiences were the same. Our politics were the same. I mean, we just really agreed about everything. And our experiences were very much the same around gay life and gay issues.
No, wait. Armistead, I know you have the honor of having gotten an award that Anita Bryant once got.
Yeah.
What's the award card?
The Freedom Leadership Award of the Freedoms Foundation at Valley Forge. We should have a drum and fife playing in the background while I say that. Yeah, I came from a very right-wing background in North Carolina. I worked for Jesse Helms, for heaven's sakes, when he was the executive vice president of WRAL Television about 25 years ago. But, you know, I think this is really interesting, this business of the fact that we came out over Anita Bryant. What happens that these homophobes create proud homosexuals? I think Pat Buchanan has done more this year for the gay rights movement than any single homosexual I can name.
Thank you, Pat.
Because he really did, he not only made a lot of homosexuals angry, he made a lot of heterosexuals angry. He made a lot of liberals see that this sort of hatred still exists in this country, because I think people needed convincing of that for a while.
As I'm sitting here talking to both of you, I'm wondering this. Since you both believe that, you know, secrets are bad things, unhealthy things to have, how do you feel about being a kind of, quote, like celebrity couple in a way? Do you know what I mean? Like how?
Well,
because I'm sure this kind of thing comes. You know, it's not the first time it's come up that an interviewer has spoken
you know,
to both
I don't,
of you.
I don't have a thing. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
We both have said, I think, in the past that it's wonderful to be able to say what we think about life and to have people listen to what we have to say. And to have the love that we feel for each other represent something and mean something to other people, it's wonderful. It gives meaning to our relationship. We're both on the same mission. And I don't think we suffer from the spotlight. I don't know. Do you, Terry?
No, I don't necessarily love it. I mean, obviously, it's much better at being in the spotlight than I am. But I feel a responsibility. You know, I grew up in Marietta, Georgia, without any homosexuals around me, without knowing that there was any homosexuals around me. I had no, quote, role models, and I don't even think that's the most important thing. But I want to know that homosexuals are out there. And if Armistead and my talking about this can make it a little easier for some 13-year-old not to feel so weird and geeky about it, then I think it's something worth doing. Because, I mean, we all grew up feeling a little different and weird, I think. But homosexual kids especially have it tough. And there's no support from the family. I mean, if you're black and you grew up black in a black family, you automatically have that support from the family members. If you are gay, you don't have any support. You just are out there on your own, and it's a tough thing to be.
You know, I've been back to Raleigh several times. Actually, Terry and I went back and
marched. It's your hometown.
Yeah, Raleigh's my hometown, and Terry and I marched in Raleigh's first Gay Pride parade about 4 years ago. And I signed books there. And I had people stand in my line, older people in their mid-50s that I knew when I was growing up, who, after I had signed their books, revealed their homosexuality to me. And frankly, all I could feel was enormous resentment. I thought, where the hell were you when I was 14 years old and terrified? Thanks a lot for telling me now. If I had known that my eighth grade teacher was a gay man, when I was suffering with my homosexuality, if he had pulled me aside and said, you're going to be all right, this is fine, don't worry about it, it's just another way of living, I would have been a much happier kid at the time. So I resent it. And I don't want the world to keep on being that way. And it depresses me to be almost 50 years old and to have been out of the closet publicly for almost 20 years and still hear that there are teenagers killing themselves over this issue.
Are your parents warm in-laws to each other?
Terry's parents are, well, my mother's no longer alive. My father's a rather hidebound conservative who has met with us in San Francisco, and on one occasion he actually weakened a little and said, that Terry was the best thing that ever happened to me. I cling to that because he's still blind in a lot of ways. I think he's voting for Bush, for starters.
And second of all, his sister tells him that he says nasty things. His father says nasty things about my having HIV, about how he brought it on himself. So he's rather two-faced when you come right down to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line, you know. And that he's very friendly to my face. I don't necessarily believe him most of the time.
Terry's mother has been wonderfully accepting of the two of us. In the beginning, it was tough for her, I guess, largely because I'm about 5 years younger than she is. And I think that was part of what made it awkward for her. But now she sends, you know, cakes at Christmas, and she says love to Armistead, and we love you, Terry, and we love you, Armistead, too. And
now, has Armistead's kind of success and your success as a writer, I mean, you're known, you're a bestseller in England and the United States. Has that helped her be accepting of him, or is that not relevant? In a way, it shouldn't be relevant.
No,
I'm not sure that it is relevant. I mean,
my mother's part of that great, vast middle class out there who might know who Danielle Steele is, but when it comes to books, that doesn't have much of an effect on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you're kind of like empirically successful.
But on the other hand, she woke up to Terry's HIV status when I made a remark in Newsweek to the effect that how odd it was to live with someone who might be dead in 6 months. And that was the very first time where she really forced herself to look at the ramifications of HIV.
Even though I told her, like, the week I found out I was positive, I told her, it's been 6 years now, it didn't sink in until she saw it in print, you know. She sort of was in denial, I think. And I think some ways she still has been. I just got over a bout of pneumocystis about a month ago. And it was during that time even that I saw her coming around a bit more to the notion that I have a terminal illness and that I'm probably going to die from it. And that she's got to accept it. If I've got to accept it, she's got to accept it. But she's been able to deny it for a long time. But because of my illness and because they were calling almost every day to find out how I was doing, and I was really quite sick, that sort of slapped her back, braced her up a bit, and made her realize that there was something serious going on here.
And she's really come around.
She has.
In a wonderful way.
Yeah, I mean,
in fact, his whole family has.
Was the pneumocystis the first time that you had gotten an illness as a result of the HIV that really totally knocked you out?
Yeah. I've had minor things, you know, funguses here or there, nothing spectacular. This is the first time, first real round of it. And it's the first official diagnosis of AIDS when you come down with pneumocystis. So I've been HIV positive until the last 6 weeks, and now I have AIDS. Not that there's that big a distinction, as we all know, but there is a semantic distinction, and it took me a little while to get used to the notion of it. After 6 years of dealing with HIV, you know.
Do you feel like you're making any big changes in your life now that you've been diagnosed with AIDS?
No, I think, Terry, the changes came very slowly over a period of years of knowing I was positive. You know, I think that makes you think about, you know, when you just have swollen glands, for instance, you wonder what the hell's going on with your body, you know. And so I think I sort of dealt with all that. I don't fear dying. I fear being sick. I don't want to have to go through being really sick like a lot of people have to do. But I don't worry about dying. I sort of made my peace with that. You know, I don't have any concern about it anymore. And I used to. But it took me confronting HIV to sort of get beyond it and get through it. So I don't really don't. It's not been that traumatic. I mean, the times it was traumatic was when it was frustrating that I couldn't feel better. You know, it was work I wanted to do on the new book, or maybe the moon, getting it out and getting it promoted and that sort of stuff. And I couldn't participate as fully as I'd like to have because I was laying in the bed sick with a 103-degree fever, you know.
Armistead, do you feel that this is something you've made your peace with, too?
Not entirely, because as Terry and I have discussed, he knows he's going to have me to the end of his life, but I don't know that about him. So there's this big, gray, amorphous area that's in the back of my mind that's labeled after Terry, and I don't know what that is yet. And I find myself preparing for it and then getting angry with myself for preparing for it because I want to live in the moment and I want to be, you know, completely there for Terry and for both of us, really, not for him, but for us, for our relationship all the time. So I can't say that I have. There are a couple of times, once last year in New Zealand, where Terry and I had a sort of traumatic legal hassle, I guess is the best way to describe it, that threw me off balance.
And because of it, I spent an evening sort of sobbing in Terry's arms, and I realized it wasn't about that issue at all. It was really about him, about simply mourning us before I'd lost him. And I'm not really able to do that very much. I don't want to do it very much. I know that time will come, and I'll have to deal with it when it happens. But
you know, grieving, as we know, when someone dies, is a very important part of the healing process. But I think you also have to remember grieving can take a lot of different forms. I mean, I feel like I have, in some ways, grieved the loss of my former self, in the sense that up until 6 years ago, I viewed myself as a healthy young man. And then I found out that I had HIV and essentially had a death sentence, you know, handed to me in some ways. I mean, I like to believe that, you know, we're all going to survive this and that whole thing. I know a lot of people who thought they were going to survive it who are dead now. So I think I'm kind of realistic about the possibilities that I'm going to die from HIV-related illness in some stage in the future. But there was a thing for me of having to sort of sort through the change of my how I view myself from the formerly very healthy, strapping young man to someone who was more fragile with their health than that.
Was it a hard decision, you know, deciding to come on the tour, because it was just a few weeks ago that you had the pneumocystis, and I've looked at your tour schedule. You're in a lot of cities,
it was hard
a different
for me.
One every day.
20 cities, yeah.
Yeah.
I wondered whether I should put my foot down about it, because Terry is a real worker. I mean, nothing makes him happier than working this tour. He's his preparation for this tour. He's never stopped. You know, he was in there every morning at 6 o'clock in front of his word processor setting it up. He couldn't wait to do this, and I was really concerned whether or not he himself would have the judgment to say, no, I'm too weak for this. But his energy's been great. He's been very healthy on the road, actually, I think, precisely because we are working.
Yeah, well, because I also plan the tour, I put a little extra time in. We spend 2 days in a city instead of one in some cases, so we've got a chance to sort of relax a bit. You know, we're not just rushing all the time. That was built in from the beginning for this very reason. Mm-hmm. But I gave my doctor, it was funny, I was sick, and I gave my doctor a deadline. I said, I've got to be well by the 1st of October so I can go on this tour.
He did. He was well by the 1st of October.
So.
Well, I wish you both the best, and I want to thank you a whole lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you. Armistead Maupin and Terry Anderson. Armistead Maupin has a new novel called Maybe the Moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.